Every once in a while, a foreign correspondent will write a few lines that tell more than columns of abstract words. And I say that in honor of an Associated Press cable from Tokyo on the second anniversary of the war in China. The attitude of the Japanese people, says the correspondent, is one of resignation, not of approval. They still believe the army is invincible, but they can't understand why the war in China isn't won and over with. Now the Japanese press tells them that it's the Soviet Union, Britain, and France who are preventing the Chinese collapse. Friends and relatives and members of local patriotic societies no longer parade to the railroad stations with bands and banners. Those days are gone. Railroad stations are relatively silent. Boxcars come in, the soldiers clamber out, and each one carries a white box containing the ashes of a Japanese soldier killed in China. Recently, the cable ends, and these are the telling lines, a widow, accompanied by her other children, came to take the box that bore the name of her eldest son. When her name was called, she stepped forward. The officer bowed, saluted, and handed it to her. She held it for a moment as though it were an infant. And then her mouth opened in a silent scream, and she threw the box at the officer's head. That's an incident about one person, one war mother, but it helps one forget the abstract word Japan and to think of 80 million Japanese individuals who were individually carrying the burden of war, the higher cost of living, the load of taxes, and grieving over their dead and their wounded. In quite another field, a few words of a foreign cable have made something else real that was abstract. These are by another Associated Press correspondent, Russell Brines, who has reached the Outer Mongolian front. He writes a not particularly vivid account of the fighting, for censorship and geography must weigh against him. But one sentence suddenly gives one a sense of space. To get to the front, he cables, he had to drive 30 hours by car across a mosquito-infested plain that had been turned into marshland by a cloudburst. And for the 30 hours, he had no food. The value of this cable is that it verifies the war in Outer Mongolia through the words of an American eyewitness. Before, it has been only a war of communiques. The Japanese won a fabulous victory in the Japanese newspapers one day. The Soviet forces won a much less fabulous victory the next day in their newspapers. Mr. Brines is with the Japanese Manchukuoan army. His account makes the war in Outer Mongolia like any other war. He heard the crackling of machine guns from the actual front a mile and a quarter away. He saw shells bursting, and six burst near his car, which had been spotted by the Mongol-Soviet lookouts. Both sides have tanks, planes, and light artillery, but Mr. Brines didn't bring with him a typewriter that could hammer out the astronomical figures that have appeared in the Japanese communiques. The Japanese, he says at the close of his dispatch, captured 5 Russians, 1 Mongol, and 10 tanks, I presume, in one day's fighting, and that is wholly credible. And he begins his cable by saying that the Japanese Manchukuoan troops apparently have been halted in the center of their line and have advanced on both flanks. And this verifies in part the latest Soviet communique about a victory in the central region along the Khalkha River. But even the eyes of Russell Brines have failed to see the larger meaning of what is happening in Outer Mongolia, or if they have, he hasn't been allowed to tell his story. We still don't know who is testing whom, whether the Japanese are trying to frighten the Soviet Union out of joining the Anglo-French alliance, or whether the Soviet army is taking the initiative to see how safe is the Outer Mongolian frontier, perhaps before joining the alliance. Another uncertainty is in Tokyo, where the correspondents give no hint of the blow the Japanese army is reported as ready to strike at the cabinet so as to reverse the refusal to enter the Rome-Berlin axis as full military partner. Tokyo mobs are being permitted to demonstrate before the British embassy. Feelings against the British is rising, which means that it's being whipped up. That is giving the setting the army people want for the negotiations of the Tientsin dispute. Now, it will have struck anyone who has read foreign news, even casually, that in 3 or 4 weeks, trouble is going to boil up in the Far East and in Europe simultaneously. Japan will be in the throes of a crisis, the army trying to dynamite the cabinet. The Danzig affair will be brought to a climax. And at about the same time, Count and Countess Ciano are going to visit Franco at Burgos, Spain. That will make it a kind of triple squeeze. By that time, too, the German reserves will be coming to the end of their summer training. And I've been informed that preparations are being made to push as many as 22 German divisions into Moravia, Bohemia, and Slovakia. They would be there, ready to invade Poland. So the squeeze on Poland itself will be very formidable. But for the present, the Danzig news is not exciting. The recruiting and drilling of a Heimwehr, or home defense, go forward, but nobody expects anything to happen right away. In fact, the semi-official newspaper of Warsaw writes again that the immediate crisis has passed and that the strong stand of London and Paris has impressed the Nazis and their plans have been altered. It has taken Mr. Birchall of the New York Times to find an American angle to the Danzig affair. Some $2 million worth of Danzig municipal bonds are held by American investors. And the Danzig Senate has voted to discontinue paying interest on them. Mr. Birchall explains that this is a strictly political matter. American bondholders who now forego their income are to understand that the Poles are to blame. They are diverting traffic from Danzig to their own port of Gdynia, and this and other economic discrimination made the free city too poor to meet its obligations. I don't mean that this is a special circus for Americans only, for of course only a fraction of the bonds are held in this country. But the idea is to awaken sympathy with the Nazis for trying to save Danzig from the economic vengeance of the Poles. Mr. Birchall points out, however, that traffic through Danzig has been rising, not falling, and at the rate of gain during the first 6 months of this year, will reach 8 million tons, the highest figure for a year in the city's history. If the municipality is hard up, Mr. Birchall suggests, it's because it is plunged into military political organization. This has cost so much that the money in circulation has had to be increased from 25 million gulden 2 years ago to 43 million in June. In other words, it's being financed by inflation. Before leaving the Danzig issue, the importance should be stressed of Britain's decision to lend up to $300 million of war supplies to its allies. This is language of an eloquence that will be effective in Berlin. A good hunk of the credit is for Poland. I may say that it's late in coming, for Poland needs munitions and needs them in a hurry if it is to put up any prolonged resistance to Germany in a war. Britain had two unmistakable words to speak on Poland's behalf if words were going to be of help, and this word about money is one of them. The Nazis are trying to break down Polish nerves, trying to panic them into peaceful acceptance of the annexation of Danzig. The Poles have over 1 million men under arms, costing at least $1 million a day, a heavy burden on a country without a large national income. This British help is substantial, and one couldn't think of a better nerve tonic. The other word that Britain still has to say is that it will not tolerate the annexation of Danzig through a peaceful change inside the city. That is, the British aren't going to permit the Danzig Senate simply to vote the city into the Reich. Such a statement has been drawn up, and the cabinet in London has approved it, and now it's being studied in Warsaw, which must agree to it before it's published. There is, however, a paragraph in the statement is drawn up to which the Poles have taken exception. It says that the British do not want to prevent free and equal negotiations between Poland and Germany to settle the Danzig question. The Poles have announced that they refuse to assent to Danzig's annexation under any conditions, so negotiations seem to them to be hardly in order. A word about the Ciano visit to Spain, which I said would be part of the triple squeeze in August. This will be the first visit to Burgos of a high official of the Axis powers since the end of the Spanish Civil War. And the Italian foreign minister is not going simply to have a cup of tea with General Franco. He's had Serrano Sunier, Franco's brother-in-law and minister of the interior, in Rome for discussions, and these talks will now proceed in Burgos, where Franco can take a hand in them. The real object, of course, is to bring Spain into the Axis. I'm not saying that Ciano will get what he wants. I am saying, however, that if he goes at the time when Danzig is boiling over and Japan is on the verge of joining the Axis, he'll be there at an impressive moment. We don't have much news about events inside Spain. The Franco regime is divided, and it's a hard regime to unify. The Falangists, more Nazi than the Nazis, are at sword points with the Carlists, the old conservatives of the old Spain. The Falangists themselves are divided. So are the conservatives. And some of the leading generals are beginning to feel that they don't get the recognition they deserve, each of them, for really winning the war. Part of Franco's following doesn't want to join the Axis. Part of it wants it vehemently. I suppose it is something that Franco's allegiance to Italy and Germany, I mean his open, avowed allegiance, isn't a foregone conclusion. But I doubt if he is strong enough, even if he were inclined to say a strong no to Ciano. I've mentioned one answer to the triple squeeze, and that's the British loan to their allies. The most effective answer, of course, would be the conclusion of the Anglo-Soviet Pact, and that answer still is not being given. And unless it is produced in a few days, it probably won't be given at all. The British have sent what is called their last offer to Moscow, meaning that if Moscow doesn't like it, Moscow can lump it. The British decline to guarantee the Baltic states against internal revolution. They do agree to guarantee them against aggression from outside. They don't ask the Soviet Union to bind itself to go to war if Britain and France get to fighting in protecting Switzerland or Holland. And since they don't ask that, they hope the Russians will withdraw their counterproposal that Poland and Turkey make a full military alliance with the Soviet Union. If they don't sign a pact of far-reaching collective security, the British and the Russians presumably will sign a simple pact of mutual assistance. It won't go any further than the present Franco-Soviet pact, and its value in an August of a triple squeeze will not be very high. For signing anything less than the full-blooded pact of collective security is advertising that the British and the Soviets aren't at all sure how much they want to help each other. The Anglo-Soviet negotiations so far are the great mystery of 1939. If they fall through, the world will ring with mutual incriminations. Everyone influenced by Soviet doctrine will say it's all the fault of Chamberlain, who never really meant to sign a pact. And the British will say that the Russians didn't want to throw in their lot with the Western powers. For my part, I would need to know a great deal more than I do now to make up my own mind on the subject. Good night.
You have just heard Raymond Graham Swing, international news commentator, writer, and lecturer, giving another of his talks on world events. Mr. Swing will be heard again Monday night at 10 o'clock.